The book of Hebrews in the New Testament was written for a world very different from ours, and it is not a very popular book, not at least with the typical churchgoer, but there is one comment right at the end of it which I'd like to use as a starting place for a series of three sermons. We don't know who wrote this book, but apparently he had some friends in prison because of their faith. And so just before he signs off, he says, "I want you to think constantly of those in prison as if you were prisoners at their side." How would they do that? What is the attribute that would let them put themselves behind bars without moving from their own living rooms? You know the answer, of course. Empathy. The power to feel with someone else, to identify with another person's trouble or triumph. But empathy depends absolutely upon a gift called imagination, the power of the human mind to form a mental image of something that is not present or visible to the physical eye. It surprises me that ministers do not talk more often about this remarkable endowment. I said in our bulletin advertisement for this sermon that imagination is one of the most essential of all qualities to give our children, that marriages fail without it, that no one can be richly human without a healthy imagination. We'll talk in another sermon about how to feed and care for this vital house guest. But let's go back now to our sentence from Hebrews. Think constantly of those in prison as if you were prisoners at their side. As if you are not there, but you pretend to be until you actually feel what it is like. And that is an act of pure imagination. People with stunted imaginations simply cannot stand in other people's shoes, cannot escape their own provincial hearts, cannot go out in mind and heart to be behind bars with someone else. The irony in all this is that if you can't escape your own feelings long enough to feel with someone else, then you are in a prison of your own, unable to get away from yourself. And another great irony is that the critics of Christianity have sometimes understood this better than we have. One of the books that shook me up years ago was Princeton philosopher Walter Kaufmann's The Faith of a Heretic. Somewhere in the middle of that book was a sentence I have not been able to forget. Listen. Even the difference between theism and atheism, between belief in God and total doubt, even the difference between those two opposites is not nearly so profound as the difference between those who feel and those who do not feel their brother's torments. I don't want us to leave that too quickly. A greater gulf between imaginative and unimaginative people than there is between believers and skeptics. It may sound excessive. I think it isn't. A person who does not feel, through imagination, the anguish or the happiness of other people is light years away from the mind of Christ. I remember the Apostle Paul saying, "Rejoice with those who are happy, weep with those who weep." How is that possible except through a very strong and determined imagination? So we can put it bluntly, I think. We cannot be good people without active imaginations. And beyond that, we cannot even be completely human if the power to imagine has been neglected. If that sounds radical, please consider it with me for a few minutes while I try to support it. First, with a case history. I was near Little Rock many years ago when the first race riots over integrated schools erupted at Central High. Etched permanently on my mind is this image. A tall, handsome girl, a black girl, a senior, walks down the sidewalk toward the school, trying not to see or hear a screaming mob of angry whites who want her to go back home. Suddenly there is more than their racist epithets, their ugly shouts. Suddenly there is something else. A white man in the crowd steps out and spits savagely and accurately right into her face. My eyes record the moment when she is fully aware of that obscene blob dripping from her nose and cheek. She looks straight ahead. She walks on with a kind of regal dignity, but any imaginative person watching could feel the horrible wound to her sense of pride and self-respect. The man who spat on her lacked a crucial element of human decency. He lacked imagination, or else he had it turned off. Otherwise, he could not have performed his vulgarity. He would have felt inside himself all her loneliness and fear already, and it would have been impossible for him to add to it. It would have been, you see, like spitting on himself. But he did not feel her anguish because he was trapped in his own fear, locked in the prison of himself. He could not feel her humanity, only his own. When Shakespeare's King Lear, forgetting for a moment that Gloucester is blind, cries out in his pain, "You see how this world goes?" Gloucester answers, "I see it feelingly." With his hands fumbling in the darkness, but much more importantly, with his heart. The world is full of people with 20/20 vision who do not see feelingly, and their blindness is even more tragic than the other kind. I do not wish to deceive you. This going out of heart and mind in the act of imagination is very costly. It's easier to stay at home and ask how people are than to break out of the prison of one's own comfort and feel how they are. To learn by hearsay is one thing. To learn by identification is a far different thing. The great American poet Walt Whitman was a male nurse in the Civil War. He wrote, "I do not ask the wounded person how he feels. I myself become the wounded person." Think of the cost to Whitman. But then think how that changes a spectator into a participant and fills the participant with compassion and understanding. Think how it would comfort you, lying ill or in prison, to hear from one who has the gift to feel the way you feel, who is no longer on the outside looking in, but inside with you. Sometimes we call it love when we can do these things. And I understand that love is always ascending out of the heart upon a journey, a breaking out of the small world of yourself to breathe the air of another person's life. I hear the famous words from Christian scripture, "The first and greatest commandment is love." I believe it, that without love we are nothing. Trapped in solitary confinement, living on bread and water when we might be sitting at a banquet table. But what I want to say in these three sermons is that we cannot love if we lack imagination. We may use people and call it love, lacking imagination. And there are people in and out of marriage who do use each other and call it love, but it isn't. As the person used always learns by and by, if we have imagination, we cannot use people, because our imagination makes us feel too keenly how it would be to be used. And that would stop us. We would be free from such cruelties. Am I foolish to talk about our being in prison? About our being in prison, we who are dressed well this morning and look respectable. Do you remember these words? "You shall know the truth," Jesus said to an audience, "and the truth shall make you free." He was talking to grown people and implying that they were in prison, but that he had a key that would turn the lock and release them. That key will not turn without imagination. Centuries after Christ, a man named Nathaniel Hawthorne looked at humanity in exactly the same way. What other dungeon is so dark as one's own heart? What jailer so inexorable as one's own self? 19 centuries apart, these two men, but both lamenting the same sad truth: mankind spends a lot of time in prison. Oh, free to drink coffee or tea, free to drive to work, free to come to church, but in painful and tragic ways, often locked up, unable to relate in good and sensitive ways to other people, emotional infants who for some reason never grew up. A baby is entirely selfish at first. I'm sure it's a trait important for survival. An infant, for a time, has no regard at all for your feelings. Ask any mother awakened all night after an exhausting day. We are sustained during these first couple of years by their innocence and beauty, and by the hope that after a while they will learn to consider how others feel, that the wonderful thing we call imagination will grow in them. No one wants a baby to remain a baby. We give a lot of time and energy to making a key that will let our child escape its total preoccupation with itself. We're not equally skillful at that. And children are not equally responsive. So our children get out of prison in varying degrees. Somebody failed that white man in Little Rock. A few of us, I suppose, are serving life sentences, never out of bondage to our own needs and our own feelings. But most of us, judging from what I hope is true of my own life, seem to be in and out of that prison, depending on whether we are paroled occasionally when our imagination wakes up, and back in jail again when it goes to sleep. One more case history, this time my own. Some people deliberately trained me when I was a child to stifle my imagination when they thought it might endanger my faith. For example, I was taught to laugh at the making of the sign of the cross by people whose religion was different from mine. I could not imagine. Hear those words? I could not imagine how that ritual could have any meaning. So I made the usual Protestant jokes. Until one afternoon, many years later, when I was reading James Agee's beautiful novel, A Death in the Family, when the father and husband was killed in a car wreck, the Catholic mother and wife turned instinctively to her faith to keep herself sane. And I can remember as if it were 5 minutes ago how I read on the page this very short little paragraph. O God, if it be thy will, she whispered. She could not think of anything more. She made the sign of the cross again, slowly, deeply, and widely upon herself, and she felt something of the shape of the cross, strength, and quiet. I remember sitting there for a long time, looking at those words, and for the first time in my life, really understanding. My imagination had released me from the narrow little notion that every person who makes the sign of the cross does it mechanically and without benefit. Given my background, I would perhaps never make it myself. But I had stood for a moment in another's shoes and realized for the first time how consoling it might be. I had made a tiny little gain as a human being. Now multiply that single incident 1,000,000 times. And you begin to understand the desperate hope behind Thoreau's question. Could a greater miracle take place than for us to look through each other's eyes for an instant? Could a greater miracle take place than for us to look through each other's eyes for an instant? I think not. And the miracle of life begins when we do it. Anna,
you rise, please.
I am, of course, deeply, deeply prejudiced, but I cannot imagine how you could have been in a better place. Thank you for coming. Show us, our gracious Lord, how we may escape from ourselves often enough to feel how others feel, so that we may love them as we love ourselves and forgive them.